Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1279.NA0206, certificate number 20354, the Tartarian Empire.
Grandpa, they'll never tear it down, will they?
Well, they'd better not.
I can't believe it. Right here where we live. Right here in St. Louis.
Just for the record, for the giant termite mounds that we're talking to in the future.
Hello.
We come from a time of cities and city dwellers.
Yes. There's a city-rural divide we talk about, but we live in a city time.
Cities are on the grow, yeah. John. I think by the middle of this century, it's estimated that something like 70% of the human race will live in a city.
Well, thank goodness that cities are such bucolic utopias.
I know, they're so perfect. You can see why everyone would want to come here. It's the economic opportunity. The cities are now the engines that drive a non-agrarian economy, and you can see why people would want to live here. But I mean, have you ever been a non-city liver? What's the closest you've ever been to non-city life? You have a Green Acres moment?
No.
Girlfriend wanted you to move to Petticoat Junction?
No. No, I remember moving out to the suburbs a few years ago.
This is the least urban you've ever been.
Well, I was grousing about it, and my mom said, "You grew up in the suburbs. Well, don't get on some high horse, some city horse." Because when I was a kid, we lived at 183rd North.
Right, in Isarden.
And now I live at 192nd South.
So if you average it together, you still live in central Seattle.
Live right in the heart of Pioneer Square.
Over the course of my life,
yeah.
I lived in the middle of Seattle.
I made it all the way to 12th Avenue. 11th. I was on 11th for a long time.
It's the joke about the mathematician shooting a rabbit, missing him in front of him, then missing him behind him and saying, "Got him." Statistician, I guess.
Have you ever been in a country? Are you been a country person?
No. I mean, like summers on my grandparents' farm, but that's like a rite of passage for 20th century children's literature is right. These city kids are going to go milk cows for 3 weeks. And we never even milked a cow.
Oh.
We just like tried to avoid the cow pies.
On my walk across Europe, I don't know if I've talked about it.
That wasn't all in cities, surely.
No, it wasn't. And I did get... I did spend like many weeks in places where there was no jet traffic above.
And you feel healthier without the contrast?
It was super noticeable when I first heard a jet, when I got under a traffic pattern and realized that this was a sound I hadn't heard for a long time.
Jet. They say that what's it called, the Ho Rainforest out in Olympic National Park is like the most jet silent place in the continental U.S. now. It's like the only place that is not on a flight path, but I think increasingly it's at risk from
China,
new Trans-Pacific routes into SeaTac.
Yeah, if you're going, that's the problem is the more routes direct from China to Atlanta, all of a sudden you're getting, well, wait, no, they'd still go north of us.
Probably, yeah. Right? That'd go through BC somewhere.
Yeah.
I think these have to be in or out of Seattle.
It's amazing how much industrial noise and just city noise we're not aware of and take for granted that, like right now, how many things can we hear There's a humming.
I was out in the San Juan Islands a couple weeks ago, and I was like, oh, right. I'm not hearing the highway, the garbage truck, the planes. The city people talk glowingly of cities. It's part of their identity, right? It's the Woody Allen speech at the beginning of Manhattan about, you know, kind of conflating the city you live in with your personality.
I wish we could get a halfway decent Reuben sandwich here. There's no secret to it. We have all the ingredients that they have back east. Why do we not?
We have all the ingredients except for Jewish people.
Yes.
To actually.
We even have some. They just aren't interested in making sandwiches for us.
For me. Right. Yeah. Is that problematic if I just want them all to open a deli?
Kind of it is, right? There used to be a great kosher section at that Safeway on Rainier Avenue serving the Seward Park community. And I think it's really shrunk.
But they all moved to Mercer Island or died.
But even so, I don't think they were like churning out the Reubens. But you can get Reubens all across New York. And they're not all Jewish delis. They're mostly owned by Puerto Ricans.
I guess now that I think about it, the Reuben is not actually a kosher sandwich because it has cheese on the pastrami. So
sure, right.
Please do not write to me.
Dressing.
I guess part of it is just the sense of superiority that city people feel, especially the ones who had to move there, who had to get away from what they perceived as a backward or opportunity-free background and had to find their people.
Do you feel superior to the country?
I mean, I don't want to, but then I go there and I read their political billboards and I'm like, I'm sure these salt of the earth people are really great at taking care of their neighbors, but they also seem to be maybe in the macro, like kind of bad for civilization.
Although on this program, every time we mention some weird little crossroads in the center of the country or down, you know, south of the Mason-Dixon line, we hear from somebody, an omnibus listener who says, hey, that's my Chick-fil-A that you mentioned. I live just a mile from there and I love all the great shows.
And we want to recognize these closeted people sticking it out there. good job. I could not do it.
There's no part of you that wants to move to a house in the country in your dotage.
I mean, increasingly it used to be a divide, and now the divide has been accentuated, not by the fact that they're both equally good, but by the fact that one America is clearly dying and this is their death rattle, right? Like they've been told that they're irrelevant and no one likes to hear that. And culturally, they did become irrelevant, I guess.
But it was the introduction of GPS in combines.
Is that what it is?
I think it is.
I thought it was like maybe if country music had stayed good.
It's, okay.
Like if Nashville hadn't decided to just sound like pop.
No, I think it was Cargill in making it illegal to trade seeds. I've got a lot of theories.
Let's listen to two affluent Seattle guys talk about what's wrong with the other America. Well, here's the thing about city living. Like, despite the fact that we take pride in it, it's...
used to.
Right. Depending on what your city is. It's bad for you. It's really bad for you.
Really?
Yeah, mental health-wise.
Oh, no.
City dwellers have 21% more anxiety.
Can confirm.
39% more mood disorders.
Sure.
Check.
Right. Also,
100% more schizophrenia.
What?
100%. Yeah. Everyone here has schizophrenia. No, like it twice as much.
You're kidding.
Schizophrenia. And this seems to be, I looked at the work and it seems to be, you know, based on where people grew up.
It's radio towers. They've been right all along.
It's the contrails and the 5G.
They've been right all along.
You are hearing voices.
Oh, no.
You're hearing voices from Ken's iPhone.
I'm going to start lining my hats with tinfoil starting today.
So there's something about, I don't know.
We're not joking about schizophrenia. It's a terrible mental illness. Please don't write.
We're just joking about 5G.
Yeah, which is bad.
Which is terrible. If they built a tower by my house, I would immediately
move. Wait, I just did the thing where I said we weren't doing something that we absolutely were doing. Yes, we were joking about it, but sorry, not sorry.
Because you were, is it worse to do gaslighting than to be unapologetic?
I just don't like that thing where people go, I wasn't doing the thing that I was doing.
Right, because it's gaslighting.
Yeah. We were totally doing it. We come from an era when you could still make fun of mental illness.
No, we did not.
We did too. We just have stopped doing it.
Do you think you guys should come back? The big guy in the white suit with the butterfly net? like running after crazy with like a giant like butterfly net the size of a human.
I did it the other day. Somebody looked at me. Oh, we didn't have a language in common. Somebody looked at me. I was standing in line and the person in front of me was doing something. And it wasn't that they were bonkers. It was,
except say bonkers.
It was the person looked at me and said, "Now, what do you want? Like, what are you doing here? Why are you here?" And I did the finger around the ear, sort of like, "I'm crazy. Like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm bananas." Oh. And the person, completely other culture, other country, was like, "Got it." Like, knew exactly what that
I were talking about them. Like, "Hey, cuckoo, leave me alone."
No. It wasn't that. It was, he was just like, "What? You're standing in the wrong place." And I was like, "I know."
How did this become the sign of nuts? Like, is the idea that your brain's going in circles parallel to the movement of your finger?
I'm not sure. Is it?
Why is it one ear?
It's just like,
you'd think it would be both. Whee!
But he knew what it was, and I was grateful.
I always go like, "Cuckoo, cuckoo," and I flap my elbows like a bird, like I'm a Looney Tunes character. No, I don't. But wouldn't that be great?
Cuckoo, cuckoo. Well,
like,
you know,
somebody at the store comes up to you and is a Karen, and you're like, "Cuckoo, cuckoo, cuckoo."
You have to see Futurelings. I wish you could see Ken doing the cuckoo because it's pretty cute.
Should we make it a Patreon tier?
Cuckoo, cuckoo.
If you're at the cuckoo clock level, sentient cuckoo clock level, you get to see.
See, I also do
my problematic
the finger around the crown of the head.
What does that mean?
That means like
your hat's on backwards.
No, I got bonked or I'm drunk or like it's the birds.
The birds and stars are flying around.
But I do it with the whistle.
See, that's good because you can do the whistle.
Yeah, and then people are like, "Oh, I get it. He
conked his a giant conked. Daffy Duck hit him with a giant hammer."
Exactly. Or I opened the wrong door and an old lady hit me with a frying pan.
But when do you need to convey that? You've just done something very confusing and you have to explain to somebody you're concussed?
No, I'm afraid that it's more of I use that to indicate a kind of mistake I might have made if I had a traumatic brain injury.
But what is that mistake? Like you forgot your daughter's name?
Well, or just hit a door jam or some other kind of like, "Where am I? What am I doing?"
Pulling on a push door.
Exactly. Like I'm traumatically injured.
Then you got to make a big show.
Little blue birds.
So cities appear to be bad for our mental health, and not just in a way, because we're looking at people who are raised in the cities, it appears to not be an effect of, well, of course, you know, people who want to yell at somebody on the bus move to a city, because okay. That's where you can yell at somebody on the bus.
People who like to be yelled at on the bus move to the city.
That's why I'm here. That's I feel like I have it coming. I probably said something problematic about mental illness on my podcast last week.
Yeah.
And this person who's having a rough day should get to yell at me about it. And also about, you know, whoever's controlling his radio.
Yeah, all the other things. Hit you with his pants. That's what he's earned the right to do.
Like I was going to say.
We are not making fun of mental illness or poverty. Yes, we are.
Well, I was going to say ranting about the Jews, but I don't want to make it seem like I'm, you know, endorsing the kind of conspiracy theories you hear on the street corner.
See, somebody's going to take what you just said, cut it up.
In Pro Tools. Like the Jews.
Or use it to program an AI and then you start screaming.
Well, anti-Semitic conspiracy theories are actually part of what we're talking about in this very entry because there is quite a bit of overlap. But, you know, talking about how cities are bad, I mean, a lot of it just seems to be, I mean, you can kind of pinpoint what the, like if you had to guess, like what is it about cities? You said noise.
That's I think noise.
For sure.
Is a big part. I think maybe too many people. Right, like we're made to be in a community, but a community where you recognize everybody, and to see thousands of faces you don't know. And I think about this a lot in terms of the kind of the rise of persecution culture. You know, we get frowned at a lot every day,
online or in real life.
Well, both. Online didn't used to exist, but just walking down the street, you know, you pass 200 people. Mm-hmm. They're not all smiling. And a lot of them are grimacing or frowning or they're thinking about something else. What they're not doing is making eye contact with you and giving you an affirmation. And
do you try to do that?
I do. I look at people and smile everywhere I go and not everyone welcomes it.
I do the Seattle thing where you slightly raise your head
and give kind of a grimacy face.
Widen your mouth like, yeah. Hey, you exist. Widening my eyes because you exist. So yeah. Do you, ma'am. So do you, sir.
I've definitely noticed that when you pass a black person, when I pass a black person, I give a particular version of that head nod and wider mouth that is that is reserved for me passing a black person. And what I'm trying to communicate is like, white hello, guilt. Friend. not a white guilt, but like, I am not a threat to you. But it is,
yeah, I'm not one of the bad ones. What's up?
Hello.
Yeah.
But it's a
but it's not for you. It's for them.
Yeah, I mean it to be like, but I'm not, it's not a passive look. I'm not like, I'm not threatening. It's more of a like, hearty, like, hello.
Do you not just go in for some kind of really elaborate handshake?
I just go right for the hug. But I catch myself, it's a different mouth that I make. And so then once I became aware of it, I was like, stop making your black people mouth, make a normal mouth, the normal grimace that you give everyone else. And so that's been part of my, I'm just training. I'm sure it's an indistinguishable
we're
mouth.
All, we're but, all learning. We're all, yeah. We're all on a journey.
That's right.
No, it's true. Like I think it's good to be aware of how social cues like that shape your behavior. Like I think a lot of the, terrible stuff we're seeing directed at trans people is because the average American is realizing how much of their interpersonal, you know, the cues they take come from gender. Like I treat, you know, I think about and treat women and men in separate categories when I run across them in the world. Mm-hmm. And as these boundaries blur in ways that are confusing to my generation, I am flummoxed. Not, I mean, I'm not, but you know.
So, are you not?
No, I'm way above these. I'm so.
I know. I know you're way out in front. I was thinking about this the other day in relation to Bean Dad, my late lamented 3.5 days of global fame.
Good times.
And realizing this, it only just occurred to me that if I had had a son, if that had been a male child, that I'd said you're going to work out this tool and open this can of beans. I don't think it would have.
You'd have a Fox News show by now.
Well, no, I think everybody that read it would have been like, yeah, that's the way, you know.
Right.
And it was specifically because it was a daughter, and this was perceived as a father-daughter dynamic, and that I was asking her to use this tool. I think that gender thing was what set it alight.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. We need a New Yorker short story by you about a Bean Dad-like scenario, but it's a son.
Oh, right.
And it's okay.
It's parallel universes, and then
exactly
they meet.
You when you mention just the abundance of people in a city, I think a lot of the research around this centers on exactly what you're saying. There's a degree of control that gets surrendered in urban life because so much of your experience as you perceive it is mediated through other people that you don't know what they're going to do.
Yeah,
somebody could yell at you on the bus. Somebody could be having a fentanyl overdose. Somebody could try to get you to sign their petition. You know, like. The neighbors could have noisy stereos, or, you know, you surrender a lot of the American idea of rugged individualism when you're an apartment dweller.
Let me ask you this. You live in a dense environment. I mean, you have fences, so they can't get to you.
I have a small yard, but I really do have I feel like I have the degree of control that comes with privilege in that.
But you have 4, 5, 6, 7 at least neighbors that border you.
If you count like a diagonal four corner
yeah,
scenario.
And then there's probably 8 if you go diagonal there.
Yeah.
And so I know that some of them are massive omnibus fans.
Probably all of them.
But
they're all listening. Watch out.
Is there one that is particularly a problem to you? Is there somebody that's always out there hoeing in the middle of the night? I mean, with a hoe, not the Ken Jennings on Jeopardy version.
Is that even a verb? A few people have barky dogs, but I think we are also in that category.
You guys have no room to complain there.
Exactly. And we don't. I mean, when the dog starts yapping, we're like, all right, bring it in. Hit the showers. That's enough.
Back in your basement cave.
Back in your cave. They like their basement cave. But no, we've been very lucky. But mm-hmm. We had a drunk guy come threaten a 4-year-old's birthday party in a previous house.
Lame.
You know, neighbors, you surrender a degree of control with neighbors who's, you know, because your quality of lives do overlap and not everybody is on the same page.
Like I've had disputes with 2 of my 3 neighbors since I moved to the suburbs.
I think you can go for the third guy too. I think time to start alienating him so you can hit for the cycle.
No, he and his wife are Christian people, and they don't put
in a good way.
They don't push it down your throats, and they winter in Mexico. And I just think they're wonderful.
They're ideal.
But the other
they
two.
Bring me cookies, and I hardly ever see them. Let's hear it for the Christian gospel.
But that's that. You know, at my old house, there was a family of people from Mexico, and 2 cousins moved in at one point, and brought their fighting dogs. And those fighting dogs had barks that sounded like cannons, and they would bark all night.
Is it really relevant what part of the world they're from, John?
Well, yes, the fighting dogs came with them.
You're saying your Danish neighbors don't have as many fighting
Danish
dogs?
Danish dogs don't. The skulls of these pit bulls were the size of, there's nothing.
Bowling balls.
No, bigger.
Beach balls.
No, bigger. Wait a minute, bigger than a beach ball? No, pumpkins. They were like the size of pumpkins. They were terrifying. And I was intimidated to go over and say, hey, you guys, like, I'm good friends with your grandfather. I know all the, I've been to every quinceañera on this block, but you guys moved in and you are a problem.
You're bumming me out.
And we finally did have it out in the street, and it was, you know, and one of them was like, well, I just bought my first house. And I said, congratulations, what a milestone. Now take your fighting dogs. But since I moved to the suburbs, I've had all my major disputes.
I think moving from the suburbs into the city actually reduced disputes, which is weird because it makes it seem like the suburbs are more territorial. And it's maybe because the people who move there have done so because they want that insularity and that barrier and that sense that their other people's actions cannot affect them, but maybe the reverse doesn't always apply.
They don't have an upstairs neighbor.
They're the special protagonists of reality.
That's true.
I mean, you mentioned the crowdedness of cities, but also, you know, the alienation and loneliness of cities can be paradoxical.
Right.
And I remember Elvis always used to say that he was lonely in a crowd, you know, and there's something especially lonely about, well, there's 500 people here. Why is nobody talking to me? Like,
well, if you're
this
Elvis,
is worse than if I was home alone listening to records.
Elvis can't tell if you're his friend because you like him or if you're his friend because he's Elvis.
He just bought me a Cadillac. Of course he's my friend.
But all of the people, I definitely, I used to work at the Off-Ramp, which is now, which one of the five names it's had since then? What is it? It's El Corazon. Is it still called that?
I think it's El Corazon.
Yeah. Still. And I was the assistant manager. I had to go upstairs into the apartments up above the bar that had formerly been a house of ill repute back at the turn of the century or whatever, and now was full of people that lived above a bar that had covered all their windows with tinfoil. And, you know, it was a fire is what it was. We had a fire in the building, and I had to go up there and knock on everybody's door and say, you have to come out. And it was a glimpse into a world of people that lived in the center of a city and were completely isolated. And
things were not going great.
Well, just like, wow, this is really, I didn't know how to feel about it. I guess I was too young to know, but there are people in every city. You look at any building.
And let's be clear, we've let them down, you know, like those people should have the support they need. And this is true of all the people we've mentioned that you're thinking of writing us a letter about. Like, we understand what is hard about urban life, and it's particularly hard when there's not the social safety net and the mental health safety net there should be.
And what do you do besides have community centers and invite people to coffee clubs?
Well, I mean, that's a problem. Like, increasingly these collective community spaces in cities are going away just because
property's too valuable.
Well, that's one reason. I mean, if you're in Turkey, it's because, you know, you're an authoritarian dictator and you don't want the people to be able to get together because they might not like you. So let's raise that space and put up something else.
We did that here too.
We did that here. But yeah, here it's the hostile architecture. It's like, you know, it's a gentler version, we would say, where, well, affluent people don't like to look at these unsightly people. Let's make sure there's no park benches and spikes on the rockery here.
Well, and it was the whole theory behind urban renewal. Like, put a freeway right through Detroit's thriving black community, tear down all of the Lower East Side, and
what
put
if we
in housing
literally built big cement jail-like buildings that were ugly, and then all those people could live there? It's amazing.
Yeah, they have basketball courts in between them.
Like, how did they even get away with it with a straight face at the time? You know,
cleanliness is next to godliness, is what it was. There was too much what they called unsanitary plumbing. And they were going to make it all.
That's just that's just like 19th century racial fear. These people are dirty.
Yeah. Well, it started with the Italians, who are dirty.
No, they're not. No, they're not.
Listen, I am not saying racist things about the Italians. I was.
Now it's when you say what percent Italian you are.
Zero.
I'm not one of them. city life is tough on people, and it's getting tougher, and it's alienating and lonely. And part of it maybe is because cities are getting worse. I mean, we haven't mentioned the aesthetics of it, but I've read a lot of studies. I mean, you're talking about green spaces going away because real estate values go up. But, you know, you can watch in Seattle, we've watched places we thought of as cute get replaced by places we thought of as ugly.
Yeah.
And obviously that's a subjective value judgment. But if a whole generation thinks that cute places are being replaced by ugly places, that's got to take a toll, right? Like, these houses used to be nice, and now they're ugly modernist boxes.
Well, you know, we think, in particular, when I moved to Seattle, it wasn't cute. It was pretty shabby.
Yeah.
But the shabbiness allowed us to live here for cheap because nobody wanted to live here.
And now it's nostalgia tinted.
But
those were the shabby chic times.
Oh, the shabby was so cute compared to like the clean, and particularly the clean and crowded. Well, one of the things that made Seattle fun to live in, tolerable as a city, was that you could get space for cheap. There were people doing cool things. It wasn't public space like a park, but there were little theaters, little pop-up kind of enterprises that made it feel like you weren't oppressively crowded by people that you didn't want around.
And we still had tree cover. You know, that's decreased a lot, but I feel like that helped.
Yeah.
Big swaying Douglas firs in the middle of a city.
Yeah.
That'll settle you down.
Yeah, they're all gone now, but not out here in the suburbs. Isn't it one of the first things you noticed when you came out here?
It is.
That there were 100-foot tall trees and you were like, whoa.
I mean, I kind of, like, my childhood of Edmonds was like watching those kind of rock at night, and then we moved where everybody had cut them down for their views, and we were like, oh yeah, there's no trees here because of rich people like me.
One of the amazing things about the trees in the Northwest is that there can be a full-on windstorm 100 feet up in the sky, and it's calm where you are, but you look up and the tops of the trees are just like, and you know, and it's a very soothing sound.
Yeah.
Until one of the huge branches comes down.
Comes through your roof. Yeah. Twin Peaks never would have happened without that aesthetic. I mean, today, like, it has to happen on a guerrilla level. Like, people kind of have to create, people say, you know what, we're turning this vacant lot into a community garden illegally, or, you know, we're going to put... I was reading about a guy that like was getting around anti-playground loopholes because, again, it's like the virulent, it's the poors that have the kids, so boo. You know, so he would, but he found out you could put a shipping container in because there was some loophole in the law.
Oh.
Puts in a shipping container and puts playground equipment on top of it. Law couldn't touch him.
Oh, how smart.
We should
do an episode on squatter culture because
I guess we did what, the slab or whatever it's called.
But, yeah, but in the 80s, you know, like, yeah, like Christiana in Copenhagen.
Is it still there?
Yeah. Well, the last time I was there, which was admittedly a while ago, but yeah, I think it is.
You were walking across Europe and got lost and got into a dead end in Denmark.
I was like, what? How did I get here?
But this kind of sense that our city, and you know, when you're talking about shabby Seattle, it still did have these tall trees, beautiful rhododendron and azalea bushes every spring, little craftsman bungalows everywhere that people had built from Sears kits in the 30s for their Boeing working class jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean,
fishermen smoking meerschaum pipes.
It was cute in a way.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, even though rents were cheap.
You could live on a houseboat pre-Sleepless in Seattle. It was still like kind of a grungy way to live.
It cost nothing, you know, like, and then that movie comes out and suddenly a $10,000 house is a $2 million house. Thanks, Tom Hanks.
I don't know if it was that fast, but yes, absolutely.
But like, it was essentially... There was some overnight thing where it was like, no one wants this. And then suddenly
everyone wants that.
So this idea that our cities are bad and ugly and modernism has made them worse when they used to be cute is kind of at the center of a very unusual conspiracy theory.
Is this a conspiracy theory episode?
It is.
Why didn't you tell me at the start? I would have put on my tinfoil hat.
You're like, I was bored. I was bored for 30 minutes of this. I got so bored I had to make fun of the Italians. What did they ever do? Nothing.
They were Catholic.
Made delicious sauces. This show was requested by a listener named Angus, and I had never heard of Tartaria, the Tartarian Empire. And in my defense, the main reason I had never heard of it is that it doesn't exist and never did.
Okay.
But try telling that to Reddit.
Is it related to the Tartars?
Kind of.
The Tartars?
Let me introduce you to Anatoly Fomenko.
Okay. Let me guess where he's from.
He's a Soviet-era mathematician. I was about to say was, but he's still alive, I think. Born in 45, so he's pushing 80. Still alive, still in Russia somewhere. But he was a Soviet mathematician, like a leading, what do you call a geometer? A geometrician?
Yeah, geometrist.
Was he a geometer? That seems like he's telling my future from bird entrails.
Geometrimatician.
Geometricalist. And topologist. Mm-hmm. So mostly a topology expert. Who, in addition to actually being a scientist, was a huge nut job.
Okay. You know what?
Unlike many scientists.
We tend to think they're mutually exclusive, but they are not.
He came up with what turned out to be a fairly influential conspiracy theory he called the New Chronology. Oh. And this is the idea. This is one of these everything you know is wrong conspiracy theories that has retroactively wrong, that has kind of shaped our new kind of Mandela effect world, where if I have a different idea than the history books, I'm probably right, or from a parallel universe and all the books are wrong.
Right.
It's a great form of narcissism.
Yeah.
No one will ever call you on your BS.
If
all the history books are wrong.
U.S. Constitution is just a garbage document that we need to
exactly
burn in the streets.
Well, what's important is which sentences start with a vowel.
Oh.
Because then I never have to register my car or whatever, right? If I remember correctly.
It's not nautical law.
So the idea of new chronology is that all the dates we think we know are wrong.
New chronology, wasn't that a Blur record?
It does sound like Britpop.
Yeah, it does.
In particular, Fomenko's conviction was that basically everything we think happened in antiquity happened in the Middle Ages. Like there's a real, we think these things happened over millennia, and really they all happened about 1,000 years ago, give or take.
Interesting.
And this lets him build a more kind of Russo-centric view of the world, because it's not
the Kievan Rus was the beginning
of
time.
It's not Greece and Rome and China and India that are discovering stuff. It was all happening right in Central Asia.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like he's writes at length about how Jesus was actually a 12th century religious prophet who was crucified in Istanbul, or I guess then Constantinople.
Was he from Ethiopia? Are we talking about black Jesus?
No.
Maybe.
I mean, if he's
Syrian Jesus.
Turkish Jesus, at least.
Okay, Turkish Jesus.
So, you know, darker.
That's one of the most delicious desserts you can get.
Every British person at Christmas loves to tuck into a Turkish Jesus. They do their little firecrackers and they put napkins in their collars and everybody eats Turkish Jesus. The Crusades happened at the same time as the Trojan War in the new chronology.
Okay.
So it's just a huge overlap of like ancient things and kind of early modern things happening or medieval things happening at once.
And what past texts is he referencing that he could put these together?
Oh, none. He's writing the texts. It's much easier. It's much easier when you're saying, hey, everybody else is wrong. Let me tell you what really went down.
But he's assuming that people will only read his books and not read any of the other books.
Well, he's assuming the other books are right in the general.
It happened,
But everybody's got the dates wrong. And once so many things make sense, John, once you see that the dates are compressed.
And did people, they must have intentionally gotten the dates wrong. What was the motivation
I think there's a suggestion that it's to put down the glorious Russian people.
Because
you know, it really makes the Greeks and Romans look better or whoever, if we believe these great civilizations predated the central, like in his view, Genghis Khan and the Mongols conquered the world because they were Russians. They were
right.
A lot of people don't realize that he was actually a good Russian guy.
I see. Okay.
Nice Russian guy with a samovar, probably.
Got that.
And, in fact, well into the 18th century, you know, when the first European colonists hit the American shores from the east, they were running up into a vast Siberian empire that had come down into North America well into the late 18th century.
You know, there were Russians here in the Northwest, but one would not characterize them as a vast empire.
No, I think Fomenko is picturing like Ohio being full of good Siberian Volga boatmen.
I see.
Spearing sturgeon? I don't know. What do you think these guys are up to?
Spearing sturgeon.
Not a lot of sturgeon in the in Ohio.
No.
Crappy.
Well, especially Ohio before before all the invasive species were introduced. Might have just been delicious trout.
Maybe they introduced sturgeon. Maybe it's all the Tartarian's fault. So he calls this empire Tartaria.
In North America.
Well, yes, but that was a colony. You know, they're centered in Central Eurasia. You know, they're a crypto-Russian people.
Right.
And they're the ancestors of the modern Russian state. And they invented and did everything by spreading all over the globe, building what we now mistakenly think of as Greek and Roman ruins in the Mediterranean, building, you know, what we mistakenly think of as Mughal temples in India. This was all Russia expanding outward.
Does he claim Mayan temples too?
I mean, you'd think he'd be a dummy not to.
Yeah.
If you're imagining Siberians moving down through North America, of course they're going to create the Mayan and Aztec and Incan empires, right?
Right. Well, otherwise, all of civilization is Russian except for these geniuses in Central and South America.
Yeah, it seems like that would be hard for a real ethno-nationalist to take.
Yeah.
The fact that we didn't have the llamas.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not going to say...
He's wrong.
I'm not going to say he's wrong. Clearly, he's correct about all this. No, it's this is kind of the answer. There's not a straight line between what I'm about to tell you about this Russian crackpot and our modern internet cranks. But his creation of Tartaria had an unusual side bloom in roughly, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, around 2016 or 2017. We see the first rumblings of an online internet conspiracy, mostly in a couple Tartaria-specific subreddits. Maybe they said Tartaria over there? I don't know. In which the Tartarian Empire is, you know, this idea of a Eurasian superstate that takes over the world is specifically applied to architecture and urbanism. And I only understand this courtesy of a really great Bloomberg article by Zach Mortis that I'm relying on heavily here, because I am not going to wade, unlike you, I'm not going to wade into these internet cesspools and find out what they really are yelling about today.
Having done it, don't bother.
I want normal people to like do it for me and then tell me why they're crazy, because I can feel very smug then, and I didn't have to get my hands dirty. And as Mortis explains it, like, this seems to be a result, this new bloom of Tartarianism seems to be a result of people who are not architects and have no architectural or scholarly background, seeing a lot of old-timey pictures that seem incongruous to them. For example, they'll see a lot of photographs of Gilded Age America, where a city has muddy streets and dirty rundown clapboard buildings, and then an amazing neoclassical state capitol or some other kind of municipal building in the middle of all this. And they think, what's going on there? Like, what are the odds?
What are the odds?
Or they see a picture of, anything, like a great, beautiful old fancy building gets torn down. Or a beautiful, elaborate building in a European capital is just being used as some kind of a post office or something. And they think, this is not plausible. Basically, anything they see, a variety of architectural schools, some kind of classical revival, like French Second Empire stuff, the larger Beaux-Arts movement, you know, any beautiful building with a lot of ornamentation, elaborate, anything with domes or towers, anything remotely fancy, which to them looks better than our modern, sometimes brutalist buildings.
Including the Alaska Club here in Seattle.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Like every city still has these. And they think, clearly civilization used to be this. And something went wrong. There was once a global superstate building these, whether it's the Taj Mahal or the Brussels Town Hall or the New York Public Library. And then a couple centuries of attacks happened. You know, Napoleon invaded Russia, and then the destruction of World War I, the bombings of World War II, you know.
Bonaparte.
Exactly. It's all Napoleon's fault. Mm-hmm. A century of something. Sometimes they say it's a natural disaster, like a giant mud flood swept the earth and wiped out this past civilization and its beautiful buildings.
You said mud flood.
Is that?
I just like it.
It rhymes because it rhymes.
Yeah. Mud flood. Talk about a great punk band name.
It sounds a little too much like something like something a fifth grader would call diarrhea.
Oh, the problem is mud blood is a racial epithet.
But not a real one, like only a Harry Potter one.
Oh, right.
If a fantasy book series is written by a deeply problematic woman,
yeah,
and she uses racial slurs to make a point, are they okay?
My enemy's enemy is my friend? Don't know.
If a woke tree falls in the woods.
I won't wade into any of that. I won't wade into that mud flood.
But they see, and they see this all over the world. You know, they see onion domes in Russia and the Taj Mahal and... You know, big neoclassical domes, and they think
there's one on 13th Avenue in Seattle.
See, because Tartaria was here. Tartaria was everywhere. It's a sign that there was this overarching global empire.
But, you know, there's the blueprints for a lot of these buildings that are in local municipal archives if you want to look.
That is the cover-up. I mean, these. The thing about these modern conspiracy theories is they're, you know, QAnon is basically a cafeteria theory. It just spews weird stuff at you, and you don't have to form any kind of overarching consistent narrative.
I see.
Like back in the day, I mean, all these old, you know, we did a show on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. All these old anti-Semitic canards were toxic and terrible. But at least they were like stories you can read a pamphlet and understand. Okay, I get it. Seven wealthy families control the world. I can see why.
Yeah.
Whereas today it's just like, and JFK Jr. is alive, and there's a pizza parlor that's harvesting adrenaline.
Yeah.
From children.
I've heard that enough. I've started to believe it.
Well, I mean, clearly.
Pizza parlors harvesting adrenaline from children now sounds plausible.
See, you're doing the thing where these online conspiracy, this is my hot take. These online conspiracy theories are catching on just because they're so delightful.
Yeah. Like, it's the flat earth stuff.
You can't help but love them. Like, I went down a rabbit hole yesterday about how JonBenet Ramsey actually never existed.
Oh, no.
And it's, you know, and I don't believe a word of this, but it's just so much fun that you spend an hour and suddenly you're, you know, suddenly there's a million people that are kind of aware of and maybe sympathetic to this, and that creates a fringe of nuts who, you know, suddenly it's off and running.
I started to, you know, I went down my own mental rabbit hole, just picturing people harvesting adrenaline from children in the basement of a pizza parlor. I just tried to picture the scene and really spent some time with it. And then
you did that oil painting that's hung behind us.
That's right. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. This presumes a world without cocaine. We already have adrenaline from children. It's called cocaine. Like, what can child adrenaline do that cocaine can't?
I believe in some versions it's like an elixir of youth. Like, we would never die if we were the child molesting Satanists in the pizza parlor basement.
But all of the bad Democrats, they keep getting older. None of them look amazing.
None of them retire?
No, well, they don't retire, but they, you know, they keep working until they're shriveled prunes.
You're saying Dianne Feinstein would know where she was right now if she were actually harvesting.
Joe Biden would have a little bit more hair, I think,
a little more spring to his step.
Yeah,
Ginsburg would still be alive, and Roe would still be alive. But there's a parallel universe if adrenochrome actually works.
But here's the problem: we're thinking too much about this.
That is the thing. Like, these people do not appear to prize internal consistency. You know, we never landed on the moon. Beautiful. Simple. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These people are just like, you know, if an objection comes up, they don't care because there's a new thread with a new photo.
Yeah.
Hey, check out this. Like, this is the Singer Building in Lower Manhattan. Look how beautiful. It was the tallest building in the world. And then they tore it down and built some ugly Mies van der Rohe thing.
Oh, because they're trying to erase.
Yeah. The great reset was some kind of either a natural mud flood or a series of wars, you know, a series of enemies of Tartaria is trying to erase it and in its place put the ugly ass cities we have today, the efficient, unpleasant cities of today. And of course, seen through this lens of aesthetic moralism, you miss the old mullions and fluting and Rococo sculpture of these old buildings, right?
Yeah.
So I understand the on aesthetic level, but the factual craziness does not appear to bother them. You know, these people will literally say there was a. I mean, it's a kind of utopianism, right? Things were better. Like, our society clearly does not have this kind of beauty and grace. So imagine the kind of people that would have built the pyramids in the U.S. Capitol in the same year. You know, those people must have had.
They were awesome.
They prized love and beauty, and also they might have been giants.
Okay.
Because these people see vaulted lobbies and big archways and they think, clearly the inhabitants of Tartaria were 12 feet tall. Look at the scale they're building on.
I mean, we can definitely see in contemporary Russians a lot of love and industry and you know, love of beauty.
Yeah. If you get some vodka in them. You piss off the Italians.
Uh-huh.
I'll piss off the Russians. Good. But it's okay because we're at global war with Russia and benevolently.
Hey, no, we're not. That's a localized, conflict between two sovereign nations.
These, what appears to be specifically, like most of the ink on these Tartaria websites revolves around things about our current architectural state of play that they find implausible. So they see these photos of one big, beautiful building surrounded by nothing, and they think, you know, there must have been more of these, and then this is all that's left.
Have you ever been to Tulsa, Oklahoma?
Hey, I mean, that's a case where a lot of prosperity did get blown up by... Yeah.
Well, and they really screwed up Nashville, too. There are a couple of cool buildings left.
Somebody got mad at us when you said that about Nashville, but then at the end he was like, if it weren't true, I would be furious.
He looked up at the Batman building and was like,
But here's what's beautiful about Tartarians. They specifically do not believe that we would have built all these amazing World's Fair concourses if they were just meant to be temporary. Like, right. They look at pictures of the Chicago, you know, the Columbian Exposition, or, you know, how all these old-timey world... Everything in Omnibus goes back to World's Fair, right? You know, they have these amazing concourses with these incredibly elaborate white-columned buildings, right?
Yeah, well, here at the Alaska Yukon Exposition.
That is now the University of Washington campus?
But a lot of those buildings were only meant to be temporary.
But that's what they don't believe.
But the problem is they were made out of, like, completely clear-grained fir because there were old-growth trees. They're built better than 90% of the current housing stock.
Well, I mean, that's why the Northwest is a little unusual. In many of these places, those buildings were just built out of, like, plaster and Paris, and then some kind of slurry made of, hemp and, exactly, burlap and horsehair. Because, you know, they just had to look good till next April.
Right. Hope it doesn't rain.
And then we're going to tear it exactly, and hope it doesn't rain. And in many cases, it rained, and the buildings were... Dilapidated. Like, last time I was in San Francisco, I actually went to the, I think it's called the Palace of Fine Arts.
It is.
You know, that big arch monument down by the Presidio?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a venue, right?
Oh, yeah. I've done more than one show there.
It's the only thing that's left from the big Panama Pacific exposition of whenever that was.
It's gorgeous and completely anachronistic in that neighborhood. Like, it's not like anything, and it's on a swamp. It's weird, but great.
Yeah, and I guess it was – what I didn't realize is it's rebuilt in the 60s. Like, if you see that thing in the movie Vertigo, you're not looking at the one that's there today. Because in the 50s, it was still kind of the dying plaster of Paris one. The rest had all been torn down or washed away by San Francisco Mizzle, and this thing was still standing. But they finally just took it down to its rebar. And built it out of actual concrete.
No kidding.
And that's why it's still there.
Well, that's a rare instance of the 1960s doing something that wasn't awful.
1960 San Francisco actually coming through.
Yeah, weird.
Well, if you want modern awful San Francisco, during COVID, I think they tried to put like a little homeless mini city there.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it's right next to the super rich Marina District people. Oh, yeah. And that did not happen.
So you're saying that those World's Fair buildings that look amazing were actually trash buildings that wouldn't have stood the test of time?
Not to the Tartarians. The Tartarians insist that these were the actual concourses of ancient cities.
I see.
Because they see postcards and they look amazing.
Yeah, they do.
And what happened was, in order to erase the memory of these beautiful metropolises, cities moved in and said, we'll turn this into a fairground, we'll put up a Ferris wheel, we'll have funnel cake, and then we're going to tear it down next year, and people will mistakenly think that these were temporary fairgrounds. But the Tartarians, not falling for it.
I see.
They know that those were where those were built at the same time as the pyramids by our Eurasian overlords.
And they were torn down in Tartarian lore specifically to erase Russian influence, not for redevelopment or something else.
Well, online, the Russian element is toned down online. I don't know if there's a bot farm in Irkutsk pushing architectural propaganda at the West.
It's the only thing that they're not.
I mean, there definitely is a kind of there's some crossover with, as I've said, with anti-Semitic conspiracy theorizing. Because these obviously these people who built this are pictured by some of these aesthetic moralists as blonde, blue-eyed Aryans,
Slavs,
who were then taken over by, you know, whatever other degenerate tribes moved in.
Like Italians.
Probably. And the enemies who tore it down are always very vague. I mean, sometimes you will see people online saying, and it was the Jews. But more often, they're just kind of shadowy forces of wealth and tyranny who have seen something beautiful and want to kill it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because, you know, this beauty used to belong to all of us. And then the twin gods of efficiency. So it's almost like this, there's like some anti-capitalist level to this. I mean, I never really thought about this weird overlap where you know,
anti-capitalism was both socialist and nationalist.
It could be socialist, but it could also be fascist. It can be like, you know, who's got the money is these 10 bankers, go get them.
Right.
You know, like that discontent of the working class can be harnessed for
a
variety of different authoritarian causes. Pick your own. And then the main thing that the Tartarians don't believe is just how much uglier cities got between, say, 1920 and 1960. Because there was, during that time, a massive redrawing of major cities where a lot of beautiful old stuff didn't have enough office space. And a bunch of Bauhaus guys were like, nein, this is what cities should look like.
Yeah. Black glass squares.
They built big glass boxes. And if you didn't, you know, if you lived at that time, you remember the conversations about it. But if you're a young person on the internet and you just see the before and after, you're like, well, there's no way anybody would have been dumb enough to do that. They don't realize that this wasn't a conspiracy happening in shadowy rooms with aliens.
It was right on the cover of the New York Post.
Yeah, architects were bragging about it. We're going to tear down this shitty old Beaux-Arts building and we're going to build a crazy glass box.
Well, it's why there's a New York Landmarks Preservation Committee. It's why Seattle formed the, you know, in response to the dream to tear down Pike Place Market, formed historic preservation.
Yeah, this is all, you know, we think of that as something that's always been here. No, it's totally a pushback to
67 movement.
It's a pushback against the new Bauhaus, the face of modernism in Western cities.
I talked to my mom quite a bit about this in the 90s because at the time I was, you know, saying, why would you have ever built these garbage structures? And she said,
well, you blamed her personally?
Yeah. And she said, you never grew up feather dusting the trim of a Victorian living room. And I said, no, it's true. And she said, my whole childhood, you went around the house cleaning it. And then when you got done, you started back at the start and went to cleaning it. And when we saw these houses with almost no trim, just flat floors, walls, ceilings, windows, we thought it was such a, you know, like a revolution in terms of just labor, because we no longer had to have lace doilies on everything. It was, you know, modernism was, it felt like the future to them, because Victorian houses all looked shabby and gross, and there were so many of them, they never dreamed we'd ever run out.
And it wasn't just the cheap labor to clean these places. It's also the cheap labor to build them.
Right.
In a time of greater inequality, it's easy to find thousands of people. You know, if you want to build a big building, why not get the best artisans? They'll work for nothing.
Right.
And you know, even more importantly, like, more efficient options had not been invented yet.
A lot of those artisans were Italian.
Oh, you're coming around on them.
You know what I mean? They built all the churches and nice buildings in the United States.
But there just weren't cheaper alternatives yet. You know, today we have factory made steel and we have concrete and all these things are cheap and easy. But back then you kind of had to make things out of massive sandstone and marble because that was the only option.
It's labor that's expensive now, Ken.
And
labor.
I'm happy to hear it. But, you know, we've talked, I think we've joked before about being in a European city and going to the post office and it's this massive palace of communication where, you know, with huge vaulted ceilings and amazing architecture. And because it's a European capital, it's still, you know, shuffling old people trying to fill out a form that lets them do the other form that lets them get their benefit or their postal order or
make a long distance phone call.
Exactly. Whatever it is. Incredibly efficient societies. But, you know, if you're a Tartarian, you're like, really, you're going to tell me that this is what the post office looks like in Lisbon? Yeah, I don't buy it. Like, even, you know, they'll look at the St. Louis post office and not understand that, you know, this was a big regional thing. You know, this is a super important government building. And they'll be like, yeah, this is not what my neighborhood post office looks like. I want to live in that world.
Yeah, right.
Who took that from me?
Indeed.
And they're a little bit vague, but, you know, it's shadowy forces.
This is one of the conspiracies that does not include black people.
Well, I mean, there is a colonialist vibe where they'll, you know, these people will show pictures from all over the world and say, this is crazy. Look at this office building in Shanghai. Look at this one in Manila. Look at this one in Sao Paulo. All these cities have these star-shaped forts. These people have basically discovered colonialism.
Yeah.
And then they've been like, obviously aliens.
Or it happened in 1000 AD.
Yeah, some super state built all this stuff. Because I guess that's easier than saying, no, just a small group of wealthy people conquered the global south in the 15, 16, 1700s. But it is kind of funny to see them just notice these same things and draw totally different conclusions. I mean, do you follow any of this kind of trad art and architecture discourse online? It's all Nazis.
Yeah, every trad now is just, it degrades pretty fast into people being mad. Modernity is synonymous with diversity.
That's true.
And so if diversity is the problem, modernity is the problem. And ultimately the fascist argument that arts are the problem, right? Because arts are intrinsically degenerate, although somehow monolithic architecture
right. That
isn't.
There's one kind of art that's not degenerate, luckily.
Yeah. Right.
And we found it, and now we can leave it well enough alone.
It's not figurative. It's not like, there's nothing degenerate about a column. It's just when you put glass around it, I guess.
I've noticed a lot of these young guys really are okay if it's figurative as long as it's sexy ladies.
Sure.
Have you seen the
can't confirm.
Have you seen that Twitter meme where it's like some guy called like Dark Triad Red Pill Boy or whatever is like going off about this sculpture of a woman, some kind of ultra femme young woman, you know, boy, the West has lost its way. Art used to look like this. No other culture would be capable of making a sculpture this beautiful. And basically all he's saying is like her nipples are poking out of her diaphanous sculpted dress.
You know, I'm kicked off of Twitter. I can't see any of this.
You don't get
now.
To see any of this. Well, this happened years ago. You could have enjoyed it in a past life.
Yeah, maybe.
But at the end, you know, and then a bunch of other weird red-pilled guys are like, exactly, man, you know, and finally.
Nipples.
Finally, somebody replies, the sculpture's by a Chinese woman, you dork ass losers. And there's a picture of the Chinese woman sculpting the pretty blonde.
Right. That's a deep fake.
That's my favorite thing on the internet. But yeah, this basically the Goering idea that you got to reach for your gun when art challenges you.
As he collected all the French Impressionists.
Exactly.
Stolen French Impressionists.
Now museums have to have the little plaques being like, sorry to whoever, somebody with a Jewish name who owned this before 1940. Right. Sorry to
their descendants.
I mean, they could give them back, but instead they put up a little plaque. That's how you know their heart's in the right place.
Give it back. Don't.
So is it harmless? Tartarianism? The Tartarian Empire?
Is it harmless?
I mean, these people just miss mullions. You know, we all miss mullions. Nice elaborate flutings and mansard roofs.
The thing about youth is that I feel like you normalize this stuff and youth are susceptible to it because they're youth and don't know anything.
They don't know. They didn't live through.
And then if they do discover more truth, this is all, it's all there underneath. It's percolating. You know, the truths they do discover.
And they've got to fit into the scaffolding they already built of how JonBenet Ramsey never existed.
And, you know, there was a book that went around alternative culture in the early 90s called Behold a Pale Horse. And it was a guy, I should do an entry on him. It was a guy that just tried to collect all the conspiracy theories into one tome where they all, it was like.
Internally consistent.
Yeah, it was like a comparative religion, except, you know, the lizard people living under the sea and JFK Jr., who wasn't even dead yet. You know, it's
or
all.
Or was he?
It all relates, right? And this book went around, you know, amidst all the kind of punk rock graffiti artists or whatever. And it actually kind of, I think, influenced a lot of who are now Generation X middle-aged people to go, maybe the moon landing was.
Maybe there's something to some of these.
And the thing is, you don't have to think beyond that because part of our generation was, all you have to do is say, and it makes you sound smart. And then you can bounce, right? You can reject any, but not reject it, just I'm just asking questions, like that whole vibe.
It's Gen X slacker approach applied to knowledge.
Yeah, and I think you see a lot more rise in this kind of white supremacy nationalist stuff that's not really attached. It doesn't have to be attached to anything. It can just connect itself to, like, no Tartarian that goes to college is going to retain that, hopefully. That's what college is for. But they might keep a little bit of the Fred Perry shirt that they got at the conference. Not 100% sure.
All conspiracy theorizing, I guess, is a little bit narcissistic. Everyone misunderstands the world but me.
Right.
Right? But these ones seem just insanely so. You know, like, can't you just go back to thinking the CIA killed Kennedy and that makes you the smart guy? Like, why do you have to think that every historical fact is wrong and, you know, you're from the universe that knows the true facts?
I mean, I think it might be related to the end of the canon, right? There was not a kid that went through public school that didn't learn who Benjamin Franklin was. But now you've got a million TikToks that are like, who's this Ben Franklin guy and why should I care about him? So there's a loss of just sort of
centralized,
yeah, here's
scholarly authority.
Here's a common understanding of the world that we all have. Even if you don't make it through the eighth grade, we will have already taught you about the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. And that being gone into the relativist world now, where it's like, well, your ideas and my ideas agree to disagree. It's a tumbling effect to people that are like, it results in people saying, well, not just that the Tartars built the St. Louis Public Library, but that the ancient Egyptians were all Nubians and
it can be in service of any kind of ideological argument.
Yeah. And then you you can read the historic record. And because we no longer care that some guy with a British accent is like, actually, I found this stone and it means blah, 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 blah. He seems just as ridiculous and comical.
I guess these guys are right aesthetically. Like, it would be nice to live in a world where every city used to be a crazy World's Fair campus.
Where construction stopped in 1930 and we left. Well, you know, in Europe, a lot of those cities are modernist because they were blown to smithereens and they had to build back. And the only,
that's part of the conspiracy, though.
Yeah. The only architecture they had was modernism. You know, the medical dental building downtown,
the one on the hill.
Downtown, the one behind Nordstrom.
Oh yes, I do.
There was a building that was originally designed to have two halves, the medical and the dental. And they built the first half in this ornate neo-Gothic style. It's a high rise. It's 20 stories tall. Neo-Gothic style with towers and, you know, very elaborate work. And then the stock market crash happened and they couldn't complete the other side. And then all through the Depression, they didn't have the money. Then the war happened. And by the time they got around to building the medical side, it was 1950, and they built it in a completely spare modernist architecture, but they're two sides of the same building. Like, they have one lobby and it's the craziest. It's the craziest thing you ever saw.
It would blow a Tartarian's mind.
I want to see what
walk by.
I want you to go online and
show
post
them that building
and say, what do you do now, Tartarians?
Game, set, and match.
And that concludes the Tartarian Empire. Entry 1279.NA0206. Certificate number 20354 in the omnibus. Futurelings, I want to be clear that all of the...
all the anti-Italian slurs.
Yeah, all the slurs and all of the...
It's a hilarious bit that John does.
All the Gen X comedy on that last episode didn't happen. I didn't do any of it. And you can't prove that I did. And if you were to excerpt it and put it into a supercut of me doing it, I would say it was a deep fake. And even me admitting this now is also a deep fake if you listen to it with the right ears. So too bad for you, bad. In the unlikely event that you don't buy that, and go on social media. You can go to Facebook, Futurelings page, where they occasionally get pretty mad at us. But then those posts go to the bottom of the feed, and the new posts are all, "We love you." Who's got the time to go all the way back? You can find us at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, although not on Twitter. Or you can find my thing, and it says account suspended.
Should people go there just to mourn?
Just to look,
like a,
yeah.
Like a wall with just, pictures of Princess Diana on it?
Just to put little flags and flowers. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and Ken will read it and reply in a snarky way if you are a dummy. You can mail us things to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Ken, looks like you got a little peachy folder of mail over there.
Got some postcards. Let me see.
Montana. There's a Disney postcard.
There's a puzzling set of correspondence from... Well, let me do these first. Ramon, our friend in Chile, asks us what we know about Bartolome de las Casas.
Is he a revolutionary?
No. The postcard is of a revolutionary, Cuban revolutionary
path.
Marcos. Ramon says there's no need to ask if he's compatible with Marxism. He clearly is.
Oh, he was a rich kid.
This is not a Chilean revolutionary. This is like a Oaxacan guy. Zapatista.
This is a subcommandant Marcos.
Thank you for using his full rank.
Yes.
For showing the respect to subcomandante Marcos. Bartolomé de las Casas is like an age of exploration guy. I think he's the one who's like pretty good and is like, hey, we're actually killing all these natives. Maybe we shouldn't.
Columbus, he's not Da Gama.
Columbus is being a dweeb. That's my memory of de las Casas. Maybe he would be a good omnibus.
All right.
We also got...
We'll do him after Behold the Pale Horse.
We also got this Butte, Montana postcard where Ben, I think, says, as I pulled into Butte, I could not remember if that mine was the toxic one or the one with an Alaskan name. So he listened to the Berkeley Pit episode again. I actually don't remember the two mines he's talking about, but I'll take his word for it.
It's the toxic.
There we go. Regrettably, I did not stop in Anaconda to see the large smokestack.
You don't have to stop. It's right there. You can see it from the road.
It appears that, if I read his handwriting right, he was on a road trip between Coldfoot, Alaska to Manise, Colorado? M-A-N-E-E-S? That doesn't seem like a real place.
Mammies.
So they listened to a lot of omnibus on their road trip. That's nice.
Yeah. You know, Coldfoot... There's not a lot going on in Coldfoot. It's
unlike most Alaskans.
It's not. It's not like what you would call a bustling metropolis. And I'm wondering what
it seems fake Coldfoot.
But there's some mining around there. But I'm just wondering, like, what the hey? What were they doing? Are they from Coldfoot, or is that just where they chose to start their?
Yeah. How did they get there? Are they doing the amazing race? This Montana postcard has a sign saying it's historic Uptown Butte. It's a postcard of a street sign, and it implies that Butte has both an uptown and a downtown. I don't know if that's true.
It is, although most of the uptown is in the Berkeley Pit now.
We have a puzzling set of correspondences from Sharon. I think this is all the same Sharon. I don't really know what order these were sent in, so it's hard to say. You know, cause
sure, they're just postcards.
Check the mail over once a month. One is a compliment on my puns. She says listeners enjoy them, and only John's reactions have changed. Now everyone can enjoy. So take that, Sharon or John.
What does that mean? You mean I'm not poo-pooing them anymore?
I think maybe you're poo-pooing them too much. I'm unclear. But then Sharon also sent us a North Dakota postcard. Ken, for $1,000.
Oh, look at that.
What is the Peace Garden State?
No, that's the Corn Palace. Am I wrong?
It is. You are wrong. It is the University of Grand Forks. No, sorry, the University of North Dakota at Grand Forks.
Oh.
This must be where they play their basketball games. The Ralph Engelstadt Arena, maybe?
It looks like a small corn pill.
I don't know if I could name the UND mascot.
Corn.
Is it the Sioux? Are they allowed to do that?
There are a lot of Sioux in North Dakota.
Yeah, but you don't want to imply that everybody on the basketball team is.
Unless it's a reservation team, probably no.
But then there's also another card from Sharon that's... in which apparently we impugn North Dakota.
Oh, dear.
My intent was for you to have fun with puns and enjoy my postcard info. Why are you responding to my correspondence in such a hurtful way?
Oh, dear.
We must have really...
What did we say?
Must have really stuck it to North Dakota.
Are you sure that that's what she means, or does she just mean you haven't replied?
That would be a hurtful way to reply to correspondence.
Yeah, to not reply.
But in a situation like this, where we often do make fun of people's letters in front of an audience
right.
of tens of thousands, I feel like Occam's razor is she did not like some joke we made about North Dakota.
It is possible to make fun of North Dakota and not even realize it.
I've never been there, so...
Oh, that's right. That's one of your states you haven't visited.
It's one of my nine.
I have been there a lot.
But even though she sent us this very disappointed note, she sent it in a beautiful Day of the Dead greeting card.
Is it possible?
So advantage me.
Is this a? Is this one of those?
Or maybe it's a threat?
Well, wait a minute.
She is sending me a picture of a skull with glitter on it.
Can you reuse that card? Otherwise, advantage.
Oh, it's true.
Yeah.
She enclosed a letter but did not actually write anything on this
very
expensive $6 greeting card.
That's a beautiful card. Now you can use it to send somebody Day of the Dead greetings.
I can send it back to her. Should I send it back to her? Dear Sharon, we apologize for the misunderstanding. We love North Dakota.
North Dakota's amazing.
Happy Dia de los Muertos.
Oh, speaking of which, it was your birthday yesterday. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
But that's going to take this show out of the eternity and locate it in
now
time.
Now people will know when we are. But yeah. Also, maybe they won't make fun of me or be angry at me like Sharon is because I'm the special birthday boy. Cut me some slack, Sharon. It's my birthday yesterday.
Does it say Dear Ken? Is she mad at you specifically?
No, it's addressed to the Omnibus Project. So you're on the hook too. You're thinking I'm the bad guy here, but what if it was you?
The problem is I'm the only one of the two of us that's been to North Dakota, so it almost certainly was me.
You actually had firsthand dirt on North Dakota.
Yeah. You know, I spent quite a wild weekend in Fargo once, many moons ago.
Is that right? Were you there for a few days from Brainerd? Because this is a movie.
I slept for two nights in a laundromat in Fargo before some guys in a biker gang rescued me. And
did the owners of the laundromat know you were there, or were you hiding in the dryer?
It was a 24-hour laundromat that no one appeared to be using.
Ah, so mob front.
Yeah, so, and I didn't have a place to sleep, and it seemed dry.
If there's one thing the TV show Fargo has convinced me, it's that the upper Midwest is full of super elaborate organized crime operations that I didn't know about. And maybe they're using a laundromat as their front.
Hmm.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe that...
No, you're there.
...does us in, that finishes us up, that awaits us.
The catastrophe we fear.
We fear may never come. But... if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, could be our final word. At this point, John does a cheese thing, but I'm not into that. But if providence allows, hey, I don't need the thing anymore. No, I'm off book. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.